Cluster Conversations, a podcast by Africa Multiple.
Well, welcome everybody to our Cluster podcast. And today we have the lovely plan to have a conversation with two artist fellows who are part of the Tandem Artist Fellowship here for the Cluster. This is a pioneer event, the very first Tandem program. And I have the great honor of hosting Anne-Marie Elman from South Africa and Epifania Amu-Adari from Ghana and the UK. These two particular artist fellows have been working here at the University of Bayreuth for the past 3 months on their particular artist project entitled Who is Lucy? Woman, Native, Other. And they work with a particular central question, and that is, what is Africa to you? Now, we will just sort of jump right in. We had the exhibition opening on Wednesday, 23rd of July, 2025, and it was quite the experience. I'd just like to sort of ask our two artist fellows, how do you feel after setting up that amazing piece of work in a no less amazing space, which is the FZA building here at the University of Bayreuth campus? Who'd like to begin?
Yes.
Anne-Marie, Epifania?
You're ready. I
can see. Yeah. Ready for the next one, I guess. I'll see how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And just loving the opportunity that has been given to us, you know, to do this piece of work together, but not only with ourselves and the ideas that we have about life and the text that we love to read and the films we love to watch, but also with others within the Bayreuth community, not only within the FZR building, but also with Igualewa House folk, and even beyond that, with the school, right, with the gymnasium, Christian and Sternum School, and some students studying art there.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it's been wonderful, really. Mm-hmm. Is what else I will have to say. I don't know, Anne-Marie, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, we had a moment this just before we walked up and saying we haven't congratulated one another, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually quite wonderful.
Yeah.
I think I was so in the thick of it, and how I felt in the moment of the opening was let's do and finalize. And I think taking a break and now being able to talk about it and reflect, it's quite a bit of a bit of magic that that arose over the last few
months. I'd like to observe, actually, that magic that the two of you have effected here in the course of this preparation for this exhibition was also to sort of actually not only envision a cluster community, but you actually sort of brought cluster members together in some imagination of a community through your interviews and your focus group discussions. I was struck by this multimedia sensitivity in your working practice. So can you say a little bit about how you were creating art, theorizing, as well as engaging with, you know, singular people, bringing them together in this practice of community building?
Yeah.
Who'd like to go first?
Big question.
Yes,
yeah. Lovely, wonderful question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you're speaking, what it made me, what it reminded me of is the struggle that I think I've had with art. Mm-hmm. So I've had a struggle with art in terms of art as exhibit. And in my mind, art was really, or should be, part of everydayness. Ordinariness,
mm-hmm.
right? It should be in some ways about the mundane, but there's also something sacred about the mundane. I mean, the fact that we three are sitting here, this material moment in time is magic, right? But many times we might just take it as a given. Having said that, then the question was, if one wanted to do art, if I wanted to participate in art, how would I like to participate in it? And I know one of the things I said to Anne-Marie after the opening was that I never want to do a solo exhibition because I think there's something that doesn't work in that for me. And so if I didn't want to do a solo exhibition, then who am I doing an exhibition with? And of course you need friends, you know, even incongruous ones, and we'll talk about what that means at some point. But you need friends to do that, but not just the friends, right? And then, and with a question like this, who is African, is a big question. It's not something that we alone should even have the hubris to imagine that we want to try and interrogate, never mind answer, right? And maybe I'll stop there a little bit, and if you have anything to add, and then I can say some more.
What we often had a conversation with in these 3 months is art, and what is art? And I reflect on, as I was born, I had this surge of creativity that I could not switch off, and it steamed from somewhere else. And I tried to switch it off and tried to learn other things, and obviously grabbing some skills. So art theory and practice, as you're referring to, it starts with the ability to be creative, where art is merely the outcome and the resultant of your labor. It's the fruit of your labor, but the creativity is the origin of it. And I think we all are creative, and it was wonderful to reflect on how multimedia has made people return to youthful exchanges in this exhibition, where I feel like a child again by creating. And we spoke to somebody else that said art is often seen as the aesthetic, but it is the fruit of your labor. If you go to an artist's studio, you see 90% of it thrown away and broken on the floor, and 10% of it is the magic that is created from all the trying and the failing. So theorizing with us is that we've internalized theorizing as independent scholars, or scholars and then independent scholars, and then being able to say, okay, how do we creatively work with it? And that's where the practice is, like where we pull up our sleeves and work with it, and then being able to interview people in a focus group where the art making as a research method has become an exchange. And that's where.
And then even beyond that, one of the things which is quite interesting, because when I met Anne-Marie, in fact, to be honest, part of the reason, because when I was young, I was good at art. But I didn't, I didn't learn the discipline, but I had this challenge that what was in my mind, I couldn't manifest it. And so this for me was very frustrating, and I let it go. And so then it meant really for me, arts that at that time was really about the object, the exhibit. And when I met Anne-Marie, one of the things that struck me about the way she worked was art was the process. And so in coming here, part of it for us has been that really the whole process of trying to find people to interview, finding out that okay, nobody is ready to be interviewed because who are you really, and going through that, doing the focus group, the postcards for the future, having people make collages, interrogating the question, reinterrogating it based on what people were saying to us, which was changing our ideas of what it meant, but also our relationships with our own thinking, our relationships with each other, with the text. I mean, this really then was the art, really, right? The process of art. And the exhibit was really what I was thinking of now as a culmination of this work. But now we're realizing it might just be the beginning of some more work. But yes, if I'm taking it maybe more concretely to this notion of Africa or roots, it made me think of what art, at least within my ethnic group, the Ashanti, was, that art was every day. So it was in the fabric, it was in the frieze at the bottom of the building, it was in the jewelry people wore, it was in the symbology that was used in the telling of proverbs, or even in the textiles, right? The using of symbology and so on.
Cooking.
Yes, so art was something that had, to some extent, function, but also deep meaning at the same time, because we seem to think that function does not equate deep meaning. You know, and for me then comes this idea of the mundane having the sacred element to it as well.
And when I grew up, art was seen as not the fruits of your labor, but rather the role of the artist is the reflective intellectual, the philosopher first, before the aesthetic comes afterwards.
And so the intellectual that informs society, hang on, look a little bit here, look a bit there. Mm-hmm. And I think to a certain extent, now that we're sitting here, maybe we've fragmented so that we have the activists. But art and activism is very much entwined, particularly in South Africa, obviously, of our legacy. Art was the way of getting the messages out, being able to protest in a creative way, in a way that it would not cause harm or death immediately. And it could reach the world and the expression of what is occurring, because somebody needs to express what a community is experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Speaking of community and experiencing, I'd like to just come back to this idea of your central question, who is African, or rather, what is Africa to you, which was the main question that sort of started off your conversations with members of the cluster. I'd just like to also come back to this idea of multiplicity that you very cogently sort of read and set out in your application for the fellowship, which basically got me ruminating on how you understand the cluster principles of multiplicity, reflexivity, and relationality, and how you brought in your own particular artistic / academic readings of multiplicity. And you say here, through our collaborative art project, we wish to acknowledge all of our African differences, including the incongruencies and the abstractions, and yet acknowledge the political expediency of having to create certain strategic essentialisms with the proviso that we must also drop them once they have served their purpose of highlighting and reinforcing our value in a pluriversal world of multiple entangled becomings. I find that a very, very powerful sort of compression of all these three cluster principles of that form of reflexivity, the way relationships are built up, and how multiple trajectories of being, of similarities and differences as regards what is Africa to you. may I just sort of ask you to sort of dwell on that a little bit in your own, artist academic personas as intellectuals and philosophers who have brought these reflections to this idea of multiplicity in African differences, African similarities. You know, how did that work for you while setting up this concept, especially knowing that you're going to be working in Africa multiple cluster in Bayreuth?
Well, it's interesting because it's making me think of so many different things, but I guess one of the things I was thinking of is, you know, they're saying in a period of 7 years you're not the same being, right? Because at a cellular level there are these changes that are going on in your body, so that even just myself as this unitary subject, both, you know, is not even what I think I am, right? In the sense of what I'm made up of. And the fact that they even additionally add on that actually 90% of a human being is actually bacteria. So there's this other question about, you know, are we even human, really?
Yeah. What makes up our humanity?
Yeah, so I start with that to say what I'm thinking of, this notion of the fluidity and dynamism of being a living organism. And this, I believe, is something that every human being on the planet experiences. And in relationship to that is not only the biology as a consequence, there's also then the cultural aspects of our lives, the social aspects of our lives, that I also think have these elements of fluidity, dynamism, and changeability, even uncertainty to some extent. But what's happened, I think, is that, so then as human beings, we're always in the process of, for want of a better word, some kind of evolution, right? But this is happening everywhere, but with the
African... Do you mean evolution in a sense of change, or...?
Less change, mm-hmm. Whether it be, in some cases, I think, adaptation, but also evolution in terms of changing, because they're also, because now with epigenetics, they're also saying that the things we do actually change us at a cellular level and make us maybe do more of the things that we do, and so on and so forth. So this kind of change. But what I found for the African in inverted commas experiences, because of a particular encounter, the colonial encounter, there has been this idea of our humanness being less than other kinds of humanness.
Yeah.
And so as a consequence of that, we have had to make a stand to say, no, it's not. And in making that stand, we've also then been forced to almost fix who we are and say, because this is what we are, and we are this only. And this has become, in some ways, I think, a tension for us, in the sense that it's as if we are not then evolving. So in two ways, you know, one would argue the colonial gaze has fixed us in the past, you know, in an anachronistic time. Mm. But in some ways, we do it also to ourselves, even if it's in contemporary time, because we then say, so then this is what it means to be African, or this is what it means to be Ghanaian, and you cannot be anything other than this thing. And I would like to insist that, no, we are always other than that thing. And so this is the multiplicity, maybe, I would say for me, just as a starting point, that we are layers of
multiple
ourselves,
entangled
even.
Beings.
Yes, something like that. But
Anne-Marie, how do you see that?
Well, I think it's one of our first bits of engagement with one another, where we say, who am I, and then who am I in relation to you, and then who am I? And we can't answer those questions if we don't know the broader environment that we are finding ourselves in. Mm. And it's the inside and the outside. So who's an African? I think it's a question that both of us grappled with individually, and the feeling of belonging and not belonging, and being outsider, insiders. Mm. Knowing that we are multiple identities, woman, scholar, independent scholar, and then we drop them and then we move on to something else. I think both of us have a wonderful way of saying we want to do something, and then we do it, and then we say, okay, I've tasted it, and now maybe I like it, I want more of it, or I'm going to move on and I'm going to find something else that I want to taste, tasting as an experience career-wise or in relationships and things. So the fact that in every moment, and I think this is where we reflected on the sacred, is that we, in every moment, emotions would rise, the body would ache, the belonging would be, and then the environment would dictate, but you should be this, or you've been raised that way, the protocol is this. But then what if something else happens that your knee gives in, or you are experiencing a nervous surge that you don't even know where the brain comes from, your neuroplasticity just, your epigenetics says, now's the time that you're going to be depressed, or how do you then become that identity through the protocol? That it's almost, and that's where the multiplicity comes in, where you say, can we allow one another to be actually just human? And bringing us back to, who's Lucy? Who's African? And the answers were sometimes being human. How do we treat one another?
I'm glad you brought in Lucy just now, because I went downstairs to the exhibition and I was looking at the two slide presentations again, and a set of images, the animated images, suddenly sort of jumped out at me, and I was hoping that both of you could say something about this. You know, there's a couple of videos. I think there's a mixture of videos of someone, a person traveling through, in a vehicle, traveling through some sort of Africanized landscape, and then there is an animated cartoon type of pencil drawing set of images. And what was interesting is that there was a superimposed MRI images of bones. I'm just thinking here in the framework of the question, who is Lucy? Lucy is the name given to this African woman whose remains had been archaeologically discovered some time back, I forget which year, and of course the very incongruous naming of this, of the remains of this unknown woman with the name of Lucy, which I heard was supposed to refer to Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds by the Beatles, which was the song that the archaeologists had been listening to while they dug her up. So how does the set of reflections around this animation here, the traveling video, the animated cartoon video, and the superimposed MRI images of bones, which to all intents and purposes could be read as Lucy's bones. So how do you see this entire sort of conglomeration of what you talked about, the sacred, emotions, the body, environment, the epigenetics of it all? How do you see this sort of being part of the conversation around our multiple relations, memories, perceptions, prejudices even, mm-hmm. as concerns Africa?
So we took on the videos as individual projects, but it was in Congress. We spoke about what we're going to do with them, and it came very much from a gut response of doing the work with the in-depth interviews, the focus groups, speaking with one another, with you. And so the story of the animated video is it's the way of how ideology can infect and affect the body, and how it starts inside and then how we interact. So if you look in the first images, it's just a body with emotions. So it's a scientist's work that have done how emotions are looked at in the body. So I've referenced his paper. It's a link there on in the exhibition. And then I created it that way, when they interact with one another, they start changing one another's emotions and things, and how we are beings that arise first as embodiment, but then how ideology can make us do different things, and where we can almost, like cattle, being gridded up and down in particular ways in the same direction. So there is that image of that animation comes in. So, and then the chaos of the chant at that particular point is that the bones are scattered. It's all over the place, and it's really. And then there's a warning skull that it flashes, and then the ideology that is very beautifully shaped as an origami bird, but the bird can't take flight. And then we engage with the origami bird that can't take flight, and we make a beautiful pattern, and it dances around, but it just can't take flight. And then we try again as an individual, as four, or as a collective, and we try. And then that's where the video comes in. We're driving to Africa. Let's go back into the countryside. Let's go to our roots. What is soul? And so that is a representation of one of the in-depth conversations where we said, returning to self is returning to home, which is rural, which is nature, which is origin. And so once we're there, we can explore, and there you will see the bones change, and the bones become almost easy to look at. And it's the bones of us as ancestors. When we were interrogating about throwing the bones, because it's a very popular thing in South Africa, it's
casting the bones.
The bones. It seems scary, but it's actually just asking the animal or the spirit of the bones to say, can you guide me through what is going to happen next? So it's a gentle way of tapping to the ancestry of that animal and saying thank you. So if we have excavated Lucy, if we see her bones, can we say, okay, we've desecrated your grave. How can we say thanks to this and honor you by throwing the bones and saying, what is it? What do we do next? Where we go? And then you'll see that the video, before that it was excavating Lucy, but then how the animations change a little bit to being a little bit more creative, a little bit more nature related, and playing with that towards the end. The drawing of the animation is it's exchange of money and time for, you'll see that they say thank you, and then wisdom come in. And the birth of self, it's a little bit of more nuance, and I don't want to bore anyone about that identity.
But just thinking of what Anne-Marie was saying, this idea of, you know, seeking guidance from the ancestors, right? Because I'm thinking amongst, at least with that kind, the idea that the cycle of life is not only about the living, right? It's those who have gone before us, and it's the living, and it's the yet to be born. And in many ways, this, interesting enough, this, maybe I'll link it back to the question you mentioned about the the need for the essentialism, but to forget about it. But in many ways, this bones or this cycle, whether it's metaphysical or physical, it's we are actually all made of the same muchness, right? We're breathing the air that others have breathed before us. They're drinking the water that others have drunk before us. And we don't even know how much of them is in this water. Mm. But even beside that, I think the science is also saying that when we are born, bits of my grandmother, actually my mother, and they come onto me, and bits of me come onto my sibling, whoever's born after me. Mm. And so this question of, you know, what are we... And this multiplicity question is a big one. But as I mentioned earlier, the fact that because of a particular encounter, in some ways, Africans, in quotation marks, have had this fixity, that it is also important that sometimes that there is this essentialized African that is then described as being as human as anyone else, becomes a necessity to present that. And to push for an understanding of that. So we talked, I think, in the text in the video about not just loving black culture and music and so on, but also the person themselves. But then this is why it's important, I guess, to essentialize it, but to then, once the point has been made, to drop that again, because otherwise then I think we fall into third, in what was sometimes described as third world fundamentalism, right, and so on. But yeah, and I'll just stop
and
there.
I think that's a very important point, because sometimes that will lead to patronizing ways of relating to one another, and then relating is in only through identity. So if we can then drop that, but and then remind ourselves that we're human, and what is it that we would need in order to engage with somebody else, and therefore honor and respect them, that that's what they would need too.
Yeah, in that sense, it would basically be a conversation, a necessary conversation from those who have been fixed into what it means to be African by others, perhaps,
yes.
Right? And how that fixation, how to be African, I am African, how that may have been internalized.
Yes.
Maybe that conversation that we are having right now is necessary in the sense of having to reconceptualize and reclaim humanity for bodies that have been declared unhuman or which have been dehumanized through the colonial encounter, for example, right? So in that sense, this conversation definitely needs to be sort of also understood in your larger context here, where you talk about African woman, native, other, right? Native in the sense of indigenous. And that's where I see valuable points of engagement between your work, as in this exhibition, with that of Sylvia Winter's work, where she identifies the quintessential human being, right? She talks about man, and then she goes into man one and man two, and we can start another philosophical discussion about that, but that'll exceed our time frames. But I'm just putting it out there. What I'm trying to say is how much more food for thought your exhibition here has basically brought out into the world. I just also want to come back to your origami birds, ideology as origami birds that cannot take flight. What was interesting was that when I saw those origami birds, I immediately thought of what Audre Lorde said in her book, My Name is Zami, where she talks about the bird without wings, who is in constant flight. And that was one of her symbols for the African diaspora. We talk about belonging and unbelonging, homing and unhoming, and how, for me, when I saw those origami birds doing that stylized dance, but at the same time, as you said, not taking flight, not attaining perhaps other levels of awareness, other levels of knowledge, other levels of richness, what have you, right? But I was just thinking about how you would read the African diasporic sort of ways of being and belonging or unbelonging in this context of what is Africa to you, and this fixity that has been imposed on what Africa means to different people, both to those people from the continent and to those people in the diaspora and those who are from the outside, who ostensibly, based on their phenotypical appearances, do not belong to the continent. So how do we negotiate these ideas of belonging and unbelonging How do we converse with the bird without legs, who cannot land, but at the same time, the bird who cannot fly?
Interestingly, in my mind, I was thinking, in many ways, I think it's just trial and error, right? It's just in doing it. Because interestingly enough, one of the things I had been thinking about is that nowadays, we are actually in the diaspora whilst deeply ensconced in our homelands, right? And I'm thinking of like one of the interviews that we had, where he was talking about the incongruity, because he's a scholar in African philosophy, but is also a Catholic. And so being asked, how can you be these two things at the same time? And for me, the argument in many ways is that, but peoples, and African peoples in specifically, have always been more than one thing at the same time. I think, you know, we talk about it even in the exhibit as being the original trickster, right? So being here, but also there, in, but also out, you know, now also then, dead, also alive. So you think of all the trickster characters that are talked about, Anansi, Kweku Anansi, the signifying monkey in the diaspora. But also within the, of course, the Yoruba tradition, right? Mm-hmm. With in Haiti is Papa Legba, is Elegua, is Elegua, I believe in Cuba is Eshu in Brazil. Eshu. But it's the same idea. Mm-hmm. And if it is true, and I suppose it is scientifically being saying, it's true that we are all genetically linked to the continent. Then, in many ways, we in a strange way we are all African, but we also are not, you know. And for us, I think it was really trying to create a space where you could hold contradictory ideas and not explode. Because I think what's happened, especially with a very sort of Cartesian approach to thinking about life, is very binary. You're either with me or you're against me. You're either this side or on that side. But sometimes you can be both. And it's why I love, is she African? Well, someone like Gloria Anzaldúa, right? Who talks about adhering to many different identities, but belonging to none at the same time, right? And recognizing it. And of course, for many people, then you might be considered questionable, right? So where do you sit? But I think the politics maybe then is love, right? The politics is love, and trying to get us all, trying to have us all cross over, but together, right? And appreciating each other as well, and the value of every single one of us, and not just a few of us. Mm. Yeah.
And to add to your question, an answer about who's African, the idea that essentializing is important to say that when it rises, it's important to claim an identity of African, because there was imposing of this is what is a good standard as a human being from a colonial idea of this is the glorified being. And how African is imposed as a term on people of the continent where it could not be negotiated. Being able to ask the question, who's an African, is a fresh question in an old context where in the past African was determined in a particular way, but does it still serve us today? And I think that's where the origami bird is not taking flight, but it used to, maybe. We've been traveling. There's diasporic. There's the rise of identity of claiming something, because it needs to. We need to say what is value. Who are valued again? The lesser than or the valuable beings around. So my point is that the colonial imposing has now become almost a capitalist imposing, that it is now about modification and exchange. It's about how I exchange with you. It cannot take flight, and it cannot breed. It cannot And therefore we have to engage with it again, return to something else. And I think this is where that question of who is African, let's renegotiating. And one of the person's interviews says, can we renegotiate it? Otherwise we're stuck in a presumption, an assumption from the past.
And can I just also come back to what you said, Epi, about a politics that requires love? When I hear this idea of love, and Sabelo Ndlovu-Gaceni has actually also talked about this in one of his COVID-19 articles, about this idea of love coming from a politics of conviviality and so on and so forth. This idea of love that you brought up basically brings me to the video that was part of your autobiographical presentation, where you talk about the value of black lives, and you talk about, states of stratification which cannot be saved by intersectionality, right? And how do you see love being part of this necessary politics as regards the value of black lives, and how does this idea of the value of black lives also factor into your understanding of what is Africa to you? I'm asking this because very often also in these multiple moves to reclaim a type of more agential humanity for those who identify as African, what is interesting is that the question of blackness is sometimes disavowed. So how do you see this assertion of the value of black lives as part of the politics of love in your view?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Well, first, I mean, I'll sort of link back a little bit to the other question, because I was one of the things you had me think about is that actually this question of who is African is a red herring. Mm-hmm. Really, the question is who is not just human, but humane, or amongst, like, there's a term, nipampa, which means almost like a true human being. And in that sense, is really a person who has empathy and who has respect for living organisms, but also the environment within which they're in, and so on and so forth. And so the idea for me of love, because I think often when we think of love, we think of it as being something that is soft and fuzzy, but actually, if you ask me, love is one of the hardest things to do. And it's one of the hardest ways to become, right? And especially if you're thinking about unconditional love. And I think because love requires a kind of disciplining as well. I mean, love requires the truth and reconciliation processes.
That's right.
Love might require reparations. You know,
love requires honesty.
Honesty. It might require punishment in some cases, right?
Yeah.
And in the sense of speaking about Black Lives That Matter, I would also say it's because even if you were to take the Christian tradition, right, this idea of being aware of the needs of the least amongst us, and unfortunately, Africans, in inverted commas, have become the least among us. I mean, otherwise, why would Fanon write about the wretched of the earth?
That's right.
Right? And so for this reason, this group becomes important, but it's not saying it's the only group that's important. And that's why, for me, someone like Audre Lorde, when she talks about there are no hierarchies of oppression, becomes also important. And for many of us, and what's interesting for me is I felt like, like in the 80s and 90s, there was a real recognition around coalition building, around solidarities and so on, and it seems to have disappeared over time. I'm not quite sure why, but I think it ties back to what you were saying, Anne-Marie, about capitalism and the market, right? Everything has become commodified.
Yeah.
So whether it's feminism commodified, you know, at the point where, you know, I mean, let me not go there to the left anyway, but, you know, certain things, certain kinds of acts are then seen as, you know, freedom, sites of freedom, and you ask yourself then what does freedom actually mean, right?
Yeah.
But yes, this commodification of selves and lives and even purpose and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at this point I'm rambling because I've taken myself away from the answer to your question too.
No, actually, I don't think that was so much of rambling, because it sort of like already sort of
relates to this idea of these multiple states of stratification that many of us were gendered and racialized and classed, and find ourselves at these intersectional crossroads of how power exerts its malevolent aspects on certain bodies, how those bodies as spaces have trouble in the spatial area of these intersections, how they can actually move through space even, right? So basically you've touched on several interesting points here as regards this commodification of lives and purposes right now, which is significantly departed from what you rightly observed about the spirit of coalition and solidarity amongst racialized peoples during the 80s and the 90s. And this was a very, very strong sort of move, especially in the feminist context, right, amongst non-white, formerly colonized peoples coming together in diasporic settings or in their own continental and subcontinental settings, for example, and having those conversations and addressing suffering, for example, right? Common modes of discrimination, common modes of exclusion, of disenfranchisement, of dehumanization, right? So the question of coalition building, the question of alliance, is something that's very important, especially right now, in order to set up counter narratives to this idea of commodification of life and purpose. Because if you don't have that commodificative value, if you don't generate profit, what is the point of your life? What is the purpose of your life? What is the purpose of your body being around in the first place, right? So that's what's been suggested to us, yeah? So I think you have actually, that isn't a ramble for me. That is definitely something that opens up a whole new set of conversations. And one of the charming things about having these particular conversations is that we are basically mobilizing Stuart Hall's model of the unfinished conversation. Because this is something that's very, very important to me, especially in higher education landscapes, where there's always this push to find the solution, set up the methodology par excellence, and have that sort of propagated as the final solution, one size fits all. But what's interesting is that if we do not come to this point where we have to find a final solution, we still open up avenues of further conversation. Now, I'm in danger of rambling myself, excuse me. But yeah, I just wanted to sort of also move on to this idea of love again. I find that extremely important, because it's sort of that discourse around love is being mobilized at the moment, especially I think in left thinking circles, liberal thinking circles, those who are in privileged positions, who can be identified as white positioned, now saying, you know, we're doing so much, why don't you love us, right? We're making space for you in the institution, why don't you love us? So this idea of love as a possible site of a solution can also be, to my mind, at least dangerously mobilized from those by those in power and those in privilege to sort of silence and sort of whitewash paper over the existing colonialities, which were built on historical colonialities. So how do you sort of navigate that as artists, intellectuals, philosophers, educators? Because that also sort of gives us that sort of grist for the decolonial mill. How do we work with that? How do we work with the types of expectations from whiteness as regards the mobilization of love? Yeah, because there are expectations like, oh, we've moved on, you need to forget that. But yet at the same time, in order to decolonize, all of us need to work together, come again in that community of practice framework, to actually see that there are tough love aspects, as you pointed out earlier. Putting the finger on the pain, staying with the trouble, recognizing the coloniality of being, coloniality of race, coloniality of gender, the coloniality of power. Right? How do we then navigate these dominant expectations as decolonial scholars who are invested in rethinking? Rethinking.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I mean, well, you made me think of several things. I mean, one I do feel sometimes we have to meet people where they are and then find spaces to remind other moments to remind over and over again, to try and keep the issues on the table. And sometimes I think that that also, that why don't you love us, I think also comes from this understanding of love as this warm and fuzzy feeling, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not always. Because and for me, that's why this idea of being able to hold contradictory ideas at the same time, mm-hmm, is a really important tool. I don't know, I really don't know how we can teach it, because one should be able to also say that, okay, this person's holding me to account, but it doesn't mean that they don't love me. So, mm-hmm, so that person also has to understand that. Mm-hmm. But I also feel as if, as we were talking, one of the things it made me maybe realize, but I mean, I don't know if it's a statement of fact, but I started thinking that I'm beginning to suspect that the debates and around sexualities, especially, and the commodification of that, has, I think, I've almost feel like it's been used intentionally to fragment us further. Mm. And so this is what is undermining notions of solidarity, because everybody's having to defend, the opposite to metadata, right? Mm. Is now giving us like other kinds of data, because even when you look at those sexuality debates, they don't necessarily they don't center women in them. So in terms of who is getting the benefit and benefits of those debates and so on and so forth, and I feel somehow sometimes these are like kind of switch and bait, right? So we're all focused on how we as individuals are named or not named, and not focused on how we collectively, irrelevant of how we are named, can change things for all of us, in a sense. But I've moved away from your question about, immediate question. But the other thing it made me realize, and we were talking about this, is that time matters. Time is of consequence, because one of the things we realize is trust is a huge necessity for the community building, and time is what. Time is a factor in that. Showing up, people seeing you, you engaging with people at different levels and different arenas for different things, and people seeing that, yes, I might not agree with you, but I know where your heart is, and it's not too far from where mine is, even though I still don't agree in how you want us to go about it, this becomes important, but yeah.
It speaks to us as using the lens of friendship, if we have to theorize this.
Yes.
That in the idea and the ideologies of this colonial thinking of identities and whiteness and blackness, and we should not be friends. We should not be sitting in the same room and doing anything together. And so love asks of us different things. It asks us to think differently, to own the skin we're in, the perpetrator, or the marginalized, or because we cannot
take ally.
Or the ally. Mm. We can't take it off. We can't, and we have to be able to say, okay, what do we do now? Once we've identified, and this is where we pick it up, we say, this is the identity, now what do we do with it? And then we ask, what is next? And love, almost unconditional love, not, I think unconditional love is a love, because sometimes it requires different things, like dismantling and unmantling, and it's painful. Like, why don't you love us? Well, let's dismantle this connection and this codependency of you having to look shiny and brand new, and maybe I don't want to love you right now, but it doesn't mean that I don't unconditionally love you.
But at the same time, it also means you are expecting me to love you, but have you been extending love to me?
Absolutely.
Have you seen me in my humanity?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I may not look like you. I'm different from you. Fine. But have you extended the very same love, that unconditional love that you're expecting from me, have you extended it to me?
Mm-hmm.
Have you extended to those who look like me?
Yeah.
Have you extended it to those who do not look like you?
Mm. Yeah. But I realize that in many ways this is the challenge, and this is why in some ways I admire people like Martin Luther King, right? The Reverend Martin Luther King, because, and not only him, I think some might argue black people in general in the diaspora, or even in South Africa, because I think to myself that if it was not for that kind of unconditional love that does not make sense, there would be bloodbaths, but they haven't been bloodbaths, right? Mm-hmm. And so then, this becomes a question, right? That do we then think that, okay, well, they're not quite serious because if you really want what's due you, you must get it no matter what? Or is it that, you know, there's a recognition that there's something bigger than me, there's something bigger than my grievance, and so we have to find ways that take us, as they say, across the waters, but take us together, even if you have to take some people kicking and screaming along the way, in, or, you know. Mm. But yes, so this this question, because in honesty, I mean, you see Anne-Marie and I laughing all over the place, but we've had challenges. We've had times where we've had to know, like, okay, I've got to step back, or I've got to push forward, or okay, there was, you know, so mm. so it's not necessarily that we you know, we hold hands and sing kumbaya all through the process, right? We also are redefining ourselves, and what does it mean, and what does it mean to be me, and ooh, okay, awareness of, oh, I do this, and okay, why did I do that? Because some of it is also about things we experienced so long ago that we don't even know ourselves, this is why I move in this way in the world, and so on. So yeah, so it's an interesting battle.
And I want to add to that, that equanimity is not always, it doesn't mean that people want revenge, they just want, they always just want equality.
They want to be heard, absolutely. Is what I'm understanding.
And this is
and seen.
And seen. Yeah. So this is after the reflections, is that the value of being able to sit and receive and be transformed, it's just invaluable. It cannot be explained. Every interview changed us.
Mm. And people, and actually someone said changed them, right? How they saw themselves, how they thought about themselves. Mm. You know, a lot of the taken for grantedness that we have. But I'm, well, we joke, stealth mode.
Stealth mode, yeah. And speaking of stealth mode, I mean, I'm very intrigued with the way you set out this question of how you have been negotiating and renegotiating your own places in positions in this collaboration, not as just as an artist collaboration, but also as a friendship circle, as a community of practice. But for me also, coming from a gender studies point of view, what I'm also hearing is that these are aspects of your feminist killjoy work as well. I'm finding this fascinating, and which is why it's resonating with me in my own function as a diversity officer, but also as a scholar who is working in the areas of gender and decolonial studies. Well, one last question. Do you think Lucy is a feminist killjoy?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I'll say yes, because they've discovered somebody who's older than Lucy now. So yes, in Morocco, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a finding of another mother, maybe potentially even an older mother, mm-hmm. right? So in that sense, it's almost undermining the very ground that we've created from her bones, right? That this is who we are. This is where we start starting from, and they're discovering that actually no, there's someone else, there's something more, mm-hmm. And maybe that's just about, you know, Africa, the continent as it is right now, right? The fact that they even say there's more, is it a biological or a genetic diversity on the continent than there is amongst all the people outside, is proof that, you know, the trickster is still at work.
Okay, how does that, that's an intriguing idea, how does that connect to the feminist killjoy idea? Where you know, there are certain assumptions of what kinds of change in thinking has taken place from dominant feminist narratives, but then you have another type of feminist coming in, a feminist of color, a black feminist, a queer feminist coming in and saying, oh no, but that's not it. No, sorry, you need to stop your joy for a moment and think about these stratifications.
Yes, because it's disrupting disrupting notions that we've taken for granted, right? So it's constantly shaking us, shaking the ground on which we walk, and presumptions of who we are and where we came from, and also I think also shaking ideas of authenticity and so on. Because one of the things we were talking about earlier is Like, for example, we have imagery of descendants, and one of them is an image of Yasantwa. Mm-hmm. And I was hearing from a friend that actually this contestation around that image, in the sense that that image is being argued that that image is potentially not actually her, but because she's so significant and there has been a lot of energy around the importance of this figure, it's now difficult to undermine it. And I think I'm just doing that right now by talking about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah,
but
yeah.
For me, what it speaks to is this question about authenticity and the ideology. So how sometimes certain things are so important that this question of truth, right? What is truth? Mm-hmm. What is reality? Is it as fixed as we think it is? Mm. And the answer, in many ways, I would argue, is no, because we're always negotiating, because it's about questions of power and understanding and interpretations and so on. Mm. And so in that sense, I would argue that the idea of a feminist killjoy is really to have people constantly thinking about why. Who, what, why, how, constantly, and that's even the feminist killjoy messenger herself or mm-hmm, himself, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. That you're always looking at this question because reality is it's changing, it's constantly mm-hmm. changing, and it's mm-hmm. not what mm-hmm. we see, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. even though it is what we see.
Yeah, I'm thinking about your question, and if I fill into it, I have to kind of imagine I'm embodying her because I have a DNA within me, and if I feel I'm like she was a being and she lived alive in every moment and had some wonderful thoughts about her environment, and she would ask a question back at us, do you think I'm proud of you? And yeah, I don't think the answer is clear, because she would be surprised at what she finds we are doing.
She'd be surprised that to what use her bones are being put.
Yes, what moment. We're doing and how we relate to one another in this vast scale of diversity that we have from her. Mm-hmm.
Having said that, having heard your answers to this, I'm personally thinking yes, that from Lucy's point of view, possibly the feminist killjoy is somebody who causes epistemic and phenomenological earthquakes. I think we will have to end on that note with another open node of engagement. Thank you so much
for this
extremely insightful conversation. Thank you so much for being here, being part of the cluster community for these past 3 months, for bringing your intellectual rigor, your artistic endeavors, your creativity, your openness to the imperfections of life in general, and bringing us a step or two forward and actually thinking about how, Africa figures into our own ways of thinking. Mm. And also for opening up the space to actually embrace the idea that there is a little bit of Africa in all of us, and we might not have to belong in order to see what is Africa to you, to me, to them. Mm. Yeah. Thank you so much once again for this time, for this exhibition, for what you have left us in the way of legacy. And I would like to thank our listeners for their attention. This is a slightly longer podcast. This is also going to be the last one for this semester as regards the Artist Fellows. Have a lovely summer afternoon and take care of yourselves. Go out and get that chocolate ice cream with your chocolate sauce. God bless you.
Thank you.